Ask Dr. Dawn is produced by Jiva Media at the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. And I want to welcome each and every one of you to this medical call-in, question-answer, debate, and dialogue program. And just say that, well, there's a little bit of a problem here. The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. In fact, they belong to the people who voice them. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. And when I say that, I'm always reminded of the printing on the dry cleaning bags that you get that say, "Don't put this over your head. Suffocation can result." It's nice that we live in a society where the obvious needs to be stated, but hey, that's just me. I returned from a very interesting conference, and in just a few minutes we'll be, I hope, taking your calls with responses to last week's interview with Dr. Jeffrey Bland about a kind of a new paradigm of thinking about medicine. But today in today's news, I've had a chance to go back over, of course, a couple of weeks of interesting clippings, and I have lots of cool stuff to talk about that relates either obliquely or directly to that very interesting conversation that we had. And coming up in the next few weeks and months, I hope to bring you more conversations. One speaker in particular had lots to say about what we really do know about what to eat to prevent cancer. Another speaker had lots of information about fungus and wonderfully dreadful stories about mold growing in your house and the awful things it can do to you. I wanted to save that one for Halloween, but I think I'm going to have to bring it out sooner rather than later. So let me just start with one quick story to wet your whistle, so to speak, and then we'll go to our first caller. Chronic fatigue tied to genes. Major study finds that mutations keep the nervous system from adapting to stress. Basically, what the experts did was they took 227 bona fide chronic fatigue syndrome volunteers, and they put them in the hospital for 2 days and did like major testing, including assessing the activity of 20,000 different genes, which is close to how many we've got. They then sent four independent teams looking at medicine, mathematics, molecular biology, and computer science and told them, figure this out. Well, including the systems people, I think, was brilliant. The teams found that these 227 people separated into four distinct groups, at least, each with its own distinct genetic profile and symptoms, all including disabling fatigue. So there isn't just one chronic fatigue. There's four of them or more. They are genetic, probably, and they don't state here in this article, but probably caused by a single nucleotide polymorphism. That is to say, one single letter off in the DNA. One little change, something that easily happens through evolution, causing a slightly different functioning, or maybe a majorly different functioning, in the gene, therefore the protein that is being made. Actually, the gene functions just the same, but the protein that it codes for acts differently, and this different acting is what leads to the disease. Or, in this case, it's not a disease. It's an increased vulnerability to environmental stress. That's how they're conceptualizing it. And at the conference last week, we were talking about individual variations in vulnerability to a different kind of environmental stress, the toxins in our food. And when I say toxins, I'm talking about natural food, no pesticides, no nothing. Plant foods are full of toxins. That's why we evolved detoxification. We'll be talking more about that, but I want to give our first caller a chance to get on. This is Eve from Kanab, Utah. Hello, Eve. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question about an herb. No one so far that I know about knows anything about it. I just know what I've read on the internet, and it's an herb called maca, M-A-C-A. Do you know anything about it?
M-A-C-A. Well,
From what I can tell, from what I've read, it's an adaptogen, sort of like astragalus or ginseng.
Okay. Well, I'll just tell you what I'm reading from. This is my little cheat sheet, so to speak. It's a very nice book. called Traditional Medicines from the Earth by Richard Scalzo, S-C-A-L-Z-O.
Uh-huh.
And I just whipped to the index and I looked up maca, and it shows up on page 85 in a formula that's supposed to be helpful for male libido, stamina, and performance, just like those internet ads you get. And let's look inside here and see. They break down. Maca is used by native Peruvians for 5,000 years. It is believed, due to the plant's effect, that the Incas traditionally restricted maca's use to royalty. Its reputation is primarily as a performance enhancer. Let's see. It has a normalizing influence over the endocrine system. That's your adaptogen. So the idea being that the hypothalamus, the pituitary, and the adrenal glands are constantly talking to each other. The hypothalamus and pituitary release ACTH and other factors which stimulate the adrenal gland to release cortisol. And then, of course, adrenaline is also included in the mix. And let's see, they did one study in the United States and found that it did seem to have a aphrodisiac effect in animals. I'm just so wondering how they scored that mathematically, but
really,
we'll leave that one on the table. So I think it's an extrapolation, it looks like, from this idea that it's a performance enhancer and maybe helps reboot the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which we often abbreviate as HPA axis.
I know that there's a lot of hype around it. It's billed as a herbal Viagra for men.
Mm-hmm, there you go.
But if it affects the pituitary gland, it's supposedly good for women as well. Mm-hmm. And they bill it as good for menopause, PMS, stuff like that.
Well, okay, let's assume for the sake of just a thought argument here.
Okay.
Let's assume for the sake of a thought argument that it actually does have a sort of reboot effect, like the hitting the reset button on your computer.
Yeah.
When things get too wigged out in one direction or another, you hit the reset button and it sort of reverts back to the same place as when you first boot up.
Okay.
If you're lucky. If things aren't too messed up and you don't have to turn the whole thing off and turn it back on again, which we don't have a way of doing. But let's suppose that it's acting similarly to that, sort of resetting things back to a quote-unquote normal place. Then that's the definition of an adaptogen. And it just takes things back to the center. If they're too far out, it brings them back to the center. So if it worked, if that's what it did, then the circumstances where it would be useful would be in an environment where there was a lot of stress. And that constant stress had messed up the person's stress response. So instead of being in, most of the time I'm a cat in the sun, I'm rested, I'm at peace with the world, and then every now and then I have to alert and do something, and then I can go back into a fully relaxed state. Now, I don't think there's many people listening to me who would describe their life as that situation, the cat in the sun who has to wake up to go get fed. It's more along the lines of constantly being interrupted, constantly having your cell phone go off, constantly having to deal with trivial email and sort through, and somewhere in that pile of Viagra ads in your inbox, there's actually email you need. So you do need to invest a certain amount of energy into sorting the stuff. You can't just throw it all away and forget about it. Then you've got the commute to work, and then you've got the kids who need to be dropped off and picked up, and then you've got a number of other miscellaneous alerting signals in the environment, right? All day, every day. And then when you come home, you relax by watching action films on TV, which, okay, so we're dealing with a chronic stress situation where probably an adaptogen that helps reset things back to where they should be would be reasonable. Anytime anyone makes wide sweeping claims of Wonder Drug,
yeah,
you know, obviously,
well,
they've got a big supply of it. They need to sell it.
I'm 55, and over the years, I've tried different herbs, so on and so forth, and nothing ever does anything to me. I'm a skeptic, and the placebo effect doesn't seem to work on me.
Mm-hmm. Well, only roughly they say 1/3 of the population are non-placebo responders.
Uh-huh.
And they're not really sure if that's the same 1/3 for all experiments. But let's take it as read that you don't have a placebo effect. Nevertheless, you're using your own body as a biological assay. In other words, I'll take it and see if I feel a difference. And if I do, then I'll assume it's real. I don't really have a problem with that as long as you're not paying, huge amounts of money for the stuff.
Right. Well, I was just about to say that it's the only thing that I've ever noticed anything with.
Well, then I'd say it's working for you, and that probably adds weight to the claims of the manufacturer that it's doing something good.
Mind you, it's not a sex thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my sense is about the whole hype about sexuality is that people, maybe they feel better, so so they feel like having sex more.
Well, that would be reasonable.
Anyway, thank you for the information.
You're very welcome. And let's hope that there's a sustainable source of this stuff, because if it does take off, it's very easy, if something's growing just in the Peruvian Andes, it's very easy to over-harvest it and kill the goose that laid the golden egg. So let's right. hope that somebody is actually thinking a couple of steps ahead beyond next quarter's profit margin.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And Ask Dr. Don is made possible by a grant from Dominican Hospital Foundation, licensed to offer charitable gift annuities with lifetime incomes. Information is online at DominicanHospital.org or by phone, 831-462-7712. So this next story is about a new device, and we're back on genes and single nucleotide polymorphisms. So let me go back and explain that once again, just to be sure you get it. Your DNA is a line of letters, right? A, G, C, T, or U, depending on whether you're talking about DNA or RNA. And this is the genetic code. And it folds up like a zipper. All of the A's link with all of the, let's see if I get this right, T's and U's, and all of the G's link with all of the C's. And so that's what happens. You've got this zipper effect, and you can have one half of the zipper and rebuild the other half, and that's how the whole thing works. And it's information, it's code. And so you could have like TTAAT, and that would be a signal. Whenever you saw a ta-ta, that would be a place where genes start, a start signal. And you could put something that would recognize a ta-ta and sit on there and prevent that DNA from being manufactured. And then when you remove that signal, it would start manufacturing the RNA, and then that would get turned into protein. But let's suppose the code that follows the ta-ta is one substitution. So where there should be a G, where most people have a G, somebody has a T. And once that's turned into a protein and the protein tries to fold itself up, that T to G substitution could make a difference in the folding of the protein, in its shape. And since most of these proteins are acting on other compounds by jumping on them or fitting into a spot or a recognition site, a geometric difference in the shape can affect how efficient that enzyme or that structural protein is, how it works. So, for example, there are 23 different variants of collagen, and it's usually one or two substitutions, and it determines how tight your collagen is or how stretchy it is, depending on your point of view. Have you ever noticed how some people are much more naturally flexible than others? They can do the splits when they're children, whereas others are very, very tight and stiff, and that tends to exaggerate as you get older. So the people who are very flexible in youth tend to get floppy as they age and have more problems with things falling out and prolapses and hernias. The people who are stiff tend to get tighter as they age, and so they have more problems with arthritis because their joints have been held together more tightly for their entire life. So your collagen, in a way, builds your body differently depending upon your SNP for collagen. These researchers found a common SNP, a common genetic variation, present in 1 in 10 people. And they were using the Framingham data, which is considered some of the cleanest data we've got. If you want to look this up, it was published Thursday in the journal Science. But basically what they found was a single SNP found in 10%. Of those, the prevalence of obesity was higher, and it went across race, and that's important. African Americans, Western European, it doesn't say if they also had Asians, but I bet you they did. This gene variation is present across all races, and they don't really know exactly how it works. At this point, they have just identified it, and they're saying, So there's a correlation here without an understanding of the causal mechanism. But what do you want to bet in a year or a month I'll be coming back to you with an elucidation of the mechanism? Because now that they've identified the association, they know which rock to look under, and that's a wonderful thing. Let's go to our next caller, Richard in Watsonville. Hello, Richard. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Some time ago, you were saying that you were going to look at an oral medication to unblock, I guess, a little vein or artery in the penis that would allow all the sacs to inflate at the same time.
Right. I think we're referring to L-arginine.
I don't remember what it was.
Yes.
You said you were going to look into it.
Well, that's why I think we're referring to L-arginine.
Okay.
Okay. I don't remember the exact call or reference. I'm good, but I'm not that good. But L-arginine is the protein that in large super dietary doses has activity on the membrane, or rather the surface of the inside of the blood vessel, and has a Viagra-like effect because it augments nitric oxide.
Oh.
Nitric oxide is the thing that causes blood vessels to dilate. So if you have impaired generation of nitric oxide, you don't get blood vessel dilation. And in fact, a loss of the ability to attain an erection is one of the early signs. It's like a canary starting to cough in the coal mine. It's the earliest sign of cardiovascular disease. And so cardiovascular disease doesn't exist yet in the person. What they have is endothelial dysfunction. Now, that's not all cases of failure to obtain an erection. Some dysfunction can be due to psychological factors. Some can be due to what we call neuropathic factors, where something's damaged the nerve that's sending the signal. But the brain starts, runs down the spinal cord, goes out a nerve, and you can have a problem at any of those areas. But once the nerve gets to the area, it's supposed to cause a release of nitric oxide in the walls of the blood vessel, and that makes the blood vessel relax and open up, which allows for more blood flow. Then there are more things downstream that kick in that allow for that blood to be retained. And so it's a complex mechanism, but endothelial dysfunction, as it's called, responds well in early stages before you've got thickened plaque-filled walls to L-arginine. I have no recollection whatsoever of a drug that like melts plaque once it's in there. That would be sort of the holy grail of such things. And I think that's probably what we were talking about. The dose on the L-arginine would be about 400 milligrams a day. And there is very good scientific work to back that up.
Yeah. As I understand, there's like three little blood sacs in the penis.
Well, they're more like long, thin sponges.
They're
called the corpora cavernosa. And there's two of those, and then there's the corpora spongiosa, and, you know, I guess they look different under a microscope. One has bigger holes, the cavernosa, and the other has smaller holes, and that's, they called it the spongiosa. Probably looks like a sponge on cross-section. And these are the things that fill with blood. So you need increased blood flow to get in there.
Right, but it seems like, you know, it works in some of them, but not in others.
Well, if
instead
a person's
of being, you know, straight erect, it's curved erect.
Right, exactly. That can be, think about putting glue inside a sponge, and those compartments aren't going to open up. That's Peyronie's disease, and PEY. And you can look it up on the internet. There's lots of cures, but actually topical verapamil, I believe, which is a drug that's normally a blood pressure medication, but somebody did a study where they made it into a cream and rubbed it on the surface, and they got some results with that.
Really? How do I spell that?
Just look up PEYRONIE and work from there. Verapamil is VERAP.
Mm.
Okay.
Because when it first happened and I went to the doctor, he said, you know, I could inject something into it for every other week for like 6 months and you've got a 50-50 chance of it clearing up.
Right.
And it seemed like the other option was to have surgery.
No. The internet's a wonderful thing for speculative stuff, and some of it'll be completely bogus, but you'll get a lot more information than you've got. We can't do the whole breakdown here on the air, but that gives you a place to start.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Michael in Santa Cruz. Hello, Michael, and welcome to the program.
Hello. I have a question about the quality of statistics in medical research and the effect on off-label uses of drugs.
All right.
I'm trained as a physicist and have worked in both physics and astronomy, and the standards of statistical analysis vary a lot within subfields.
Oh, yeah.
In some places, they're accustomed to working with small amounts of data and know the statistical techniques around Monte Carlo analysis and splitting your data into subsets to try not to produce a spurious coincidence kind of a conclusion as something scientifically proven. And in other disciplines, with all the goodwill in the world, they just aren't familiar with how easy it is to hit a coincidence and see it as causation.
Uh-huh.
When you study a drug particularly for off-label prescription uses, do you try to evaluate the quality of the statistics? to go into that.
Okay, well, Michael, you are obviously a scientist and probably not involved in the marketing world. So just the nature of your question tells me that. I have bad news for you. Things are rarely studied for off-label use in formal scientific studies. Drugs are invented by drug companies, which want to sell them. They find a effect of their drug, which is demonstrable in an N of, let's say, 4,000, somewhere between 1,000 and 4,000 people. Very few studies are larger than 4,000 for drug studies. So mostly what they do is a couple hundred people with a index disease or an index condition try to show a statistics to an alpha of 0.05, and it's straight like students' t-test type statistics most of the time. It's very, very basic stuff. And that means, as I'm often fond of telling people, that there's a 1 in 20 chance that this is just random chance and not an effect. So we rely on replication. And the companies are usually required to do several studies at several different places and show that they still have a statistically significant effect. At that point, assuming that the toxicity studies show low toxicity, the drug is approved for use in the population for that condition. There is absolutely no requirement that doctors pay attention to what it's approved for. Once a drug is approved by the FDA for use for any condition, it immediately starts to be played with informally to see what else it can do. So, you know, show me what you got kind of approach. The manufacturers are not really allowed to do this. They can if they want to do formal studies. This stage of it kind of proceeds informally. And when someone's got something that seems like, oh yeah, this is working for this, like, for example, the study that was just published about Evista or raloxifene having a benefit in breast cancer. You know, just on the basis of the mechanism of the drug, you have two drugs being developed, tamoxifen and raloxifene. All right? They're being developed about the same time. Two different companies are working on the molecule. One of them goes after the breast cancer indication, showing that it blocks estrogen receptors in the breast and therefore is beneficial for post-chemotherapy prophylaxis to prevent the breast cancer from recurring. They get that indication. Drug becomes widely used. That company makes a lot of money. But second company, different molecule, doesn't maybe have quite the same affinity for the breast tissue in the test tube. So they say, well, you know, maybe it's not as strong as tamoxifen. What else can it do? Oh, look at that. Fixes bones. It's good for osteoporosis. Why don't we go after an osteoporosis indication, which is what they did. So that drug's been widely distributed to women for osteoporosis prevention. But anybody who, like, looks at the molecule and thinks about it goes, you know, that might work just as well as tamoxifen for breast cancer. That's not been established yet. But I've informally told people that you may get a benefit here. I can't swear to it because the data's not there. I bet you there's people out there off-label who've been using raloxifene for breast cancer prevention because it doesn't have as many complications as tamoxifen. So it's actually a safer drug. So it's a total Wild West. It's not clean and pure and pristine and scientific and orderly the way real science is. And part of that's because humans aren't lab animals. You can rarely get them to even take the drug, let alone take it consistently at the same time of day and not do anything else so that you can be pure in your science.
Well, I think of it as real science because you're doing the best you can with limited data, and that is real science. But I guess, is there a standard that you hold off-label uses to as far as reviewing the literature in support of?
No, I don't, and I'll tell you why. I think that our entire scientific, you know, medical scientific literature, and I include the literature on herbs as well as the literature on drugs, is based on a false premise, a really deep, fundamentally false premise. Unfortunately, we've reached one of those everything you know is wrong moments in our science, and we're going to have to go back and rethink everything over the next few years. And it's because of these new microarray tools that are coming out. The one that I just talked about, Biafa Matrix, which is for finding the fat gene. There's another one another company has out. And what they allow us to do is look at genetic variants, look at the differences in these small single nucleotide polymorphisms. And that's key to response to just about every drug, every herb, and they're different. There's several layers of complexity, which I won't get into, but let's just say there's feedback loops on top of there being genetic differences. There's differences genetically in how the feedback loops work.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody is truly unique, and we've been ignoring that uniqueness because the basic premise of the way we do the studies is that our placebo group and our regular intervention group are the same, and that everybody within the intervention group, they're going to be more similar than they are different. And that's the whole point of randomization. We probably aren't doing that. And so when you see differences in results, you have to throw out now, are we failing to be statistically significant because we have a different genetic mix in these two studies? And what's the subgroup that's actually responding? And so I predict that within the next few years, all drug studies will undergo a sort of secondary level of looking at the major population subtypes that are identified. So the maybe down to the fifth percentile of the population, we'll know with respect to this drug what the genetic variations that could affect response are, and we'll be able to say, okay, this drug works really well if you have this particular 2D6 cytochrome P450, but if you have this one, this drug is toxic to you and you don't get to take it. You know, everything we know is based on a premise that people are pretty much the same, and now we are learning that they are, in fact, pretty much different. And like I said, almost all of our work, almost all of what we know now has to be qualified as being probably wrong in a certain percentage of cases. It's a very spooky moment for me, actually.
If that's the case, it puts the premium on dosage monitoring and outcome monitoring in the clinical setting. It means we need more doctors.
It means that we need to know what we need to monitor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's step one. And you're right, we do need more doctors, and we do need doctors to be educated to this. And I was going to use this for my editorial, but to state the false premise explicitly, the false premise is people are enough the same that we can average the results and learn something that's fundamentally true about people. And what we're now seeing is that people are not enough the same that we can average the results. When we average the results, we end up destroying the information, turning it into statistically insignificant and therefore dismissible. And so what we've been throwing out is actually where the important stuff lies. Where do we go from here, I think, is, first of all, we are in the middle of a trend in medicine towards standardization, and that's being partially driven by a very laudable desire to use computers. Computers help you manage large quantities of data, that you can put ticklers in computers, you can put in a drug, and the computer will go, wait a minute, he's on this drug, and pop up in interactions. That, by the way, has not worked even slightly. You have to turn off your interactions programs because it false alarms too often. And so that would be nice, and someday we'll get it, but we don't have it yet. But the problem with computers is they don't allow you to override the defaults very easily. These current primitive decision software systems and computer medical records that I've implemented in my office, that the hospital's implemented, actually force you to do very standardized care. And this is coming at a moment when I'm beginning to realize that individualized care is critical to doing good medicine. And I'm simultaneously introducing a tool into my environment which is going to make it more difficult for me to do the thing that I should be doing. So the future of medicine is going to run smack dab into this wall that we've created, thinking that we were creating the 21st century medicine by adding all these computers into it. But we're really going to get ourselves in trouble. I'm a bit disturbed and concerned about what the next 10 years is going to look like as the protocol people battle it out with the SNP people. And we're definitely at one of those moments where there's two different tides and they're going to smash into each other. Eventually, the individual people will win and the SNP people will win. As we develop more data and more machines to help us assess the individuality, we'll be able to construct it. Once we can construct it, it'll be acceptable to people. Right now, it's just scary and people want to reject it and pretend it isn't important.
Mm-hmm. So a broad brush population statistics approach worked pretty well with pathogen-based disease, but just isn't working for the more recently recognized autoimmune.
Yeah, well, you can even argue that the pathogen-based disease is based on the false premise being more or less equal vulnerability to the disease. So think about what happens when smallpox from a European population, which when they get smallpox, they have a 10% die-off, hits an American Indian population, which has like 95% die-off from the same disease. And it's not just naive immunity. There's actually enough differences in the DNA to affect the vulnerability to the condition. So Europe's been selected against smallpox, right? You've killed off generations of people who are more vulnerable. So you probably have different SNPs, in fact, almost certainly. So that's how bacteria develop resistance. Besides just developing enzymes, they can also develop other forms of resistance, and they're being selected for. And the diseases select for us. They select for resistant humans. The diseases need to be spread in order to survive, right? So they need to select for resistant humans that won't quite die, that'll live long enough to spread it to the next village. If you wipe everybody out in 5 minutes, then you die out. This is why in flu epidemics we see an attenuation of the flu virus. The initial flu virus may be very, very pathogenic, but after a couple of months you start to see a weaker version of the flu emerge, because that's the one that got to travel. The really strong version of the flu killed you before you could move it. Think about it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a big, complex web, very complex and very big, and we're constantly having back and forth between the environment and our bodies and our DNA. And I guess the take-home lesson is it's a different way of looking at the world. And we've been very comfortable in our nice reductionist, let's do cardiovascular research and let's work on the blood vessel wall, with the assumption that what comes out of the lab on the blood vessel wall is actually going to generalize to a living entity. And then we try it in rats, and half the time we have to throw it out because it doesn't generalize. And then if it works in rats, we get really excited because 90% of the stuff's gotten thrown out by now. And then we try it in humans, and maybe 10% of that doesn't kill the humans or doesn't make the humans sick, and then we can move forward from there. But it's a much more challenging process than mathematics or even astronomy or physics, because you have the ability to model. I'm not saying that physics is simple. God forbid, I should say.
It is simple by comparison.
You've got more stuff that you can see and model, and here it really is, so much of it's going on in a black box, and it turns out there's not one black box, but hundreds.
In physics, you don't try to do something constructive with information that doesn't really tell you the mechanism. It just tells you something works.
Exactly. Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed the conversation. Any last words?
Just given the current state of medicine, how would you recommend? Do you focus on mechanism? Do you say, I'll prescribe this drug because the mechanism is plausible? Or how do you make a rational decision whether to believe in an off-label use?
That's a very complicated question, which I'll try to respond to briefly. But I take a look at the individual and the severity of the situation and what I know about the general constitution of the individual, because you can sort of broadly classify people into resilient and sensitive to perturbations, and that could be environmental or herbal or whatever. And then if I've got someone who seems fairly resilient and they have a condition that warrants it, then I look at the toxicity of the agent and decide how much risk I'm actually taking for them. And we have a sense that if you give it to 4,000 people, you'll find most common things. Then if it's out there for 5 or 6 years, and it's been out in the environment being used widely for some condition or other, then any other weird variant problem will probably have emerged, even with our extremely flawed reporting system. So after 4 or 5 years, if there's nothing whiffing around, like, for example, the articles on Vioxx first came out in 2001, which was about 18 months after Vioxx was released, there was like, you know, maybe there might be some problems here with cardiovascular and clotting, but it was there, and it was sort of speculative. The manufacturers of the opposing drugs were pointing it out to me. Oddly enough, the marketing works for me there, because whoever's in competition will data mine the negative literature for some reason to scare me about using their opponent's product. So that, oddly enough, I heard about Vioxx's problems from the Bextra people 3 years before Vioxx was pulled. So I wait 5 years, unless I've got a really serious condition where additional risk is warranted. But I'm never early to use a drug unless there is absolutely nothing around that works. We had a problem with Protopic, okay? This was a drug that was supposed to be safer than steroids for children. We were going to give it to them for eczema. And the parents are all freaked out. You have to really twist their arm to give steroids. So a lot of doctors adopted that one early. That one made very good money for a couple of years. And then, oops, funny skin cancers start showing up. And whoops, when you suppress the immune system enough to fix the eczema, you also increase the risk for skin cancers. And so, oh well, that's what you get for adopting something before 5 years are up.
Mm-hmm. So in some ways, you'd prefer an established drug with an off-label use than
I love generics now. You have to be around for 17 years, and then you have to go through a second FDA review before you can become a generic. So I'm like big on generics because I know where the trap doors are in those drugs, and I pretty much know what to do about them. There's been plenty of time to figure them out. And so I feel more comfortable using generics. Sometimes it's harder to get people to take generics for various reasons. There's a perception that they're inferior, for example, and often they have to be taken more than once a day, which, you know, it's sort of ridiculous that we whine about taking a pill more than once a day, but we've been trained by the drug companies that that's some kind of come down. So there you go.
Well, thank you very much.
I've enjoyed our conversation. I hope you'll call back sometime, Michael.
I will.
Bye-bye. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, and you're listening to Ask Dr. Dawn. Ask Dr. Dawn is made possible by a grant from John F. Kennedy University's Graduate School of Professional Psychology in Campbell, offering a master's degree in counseling psychology designed for busy adults. Information available at 800-868-2359. KUSP's Live at Lunch music sessions are now available as podcasts at KUSP.org. These sessions are recorded live in our studios and broadcast on KUSP. Podcasting is free and allows those performances to be automatically downloaded to your computer. Just go to KUSP.org and click podcasts to find instructions and subscribe. Ask Dr. Dawn is made possible by a grant from Well Within Spa. Well Within offers massage therapy, face and body care, and private spa rooms overlooking a Japanese garden in downtown Santa Cruz. Information is available at 458-WELL and online at wellwithinspa.com. I had an off-air request to repeat the title of the book, Traditional Medicines from the Earth, and the author is Richard Scalzo, S-C-A-L-Z-O, and also Michael Cronin. And let's see, looking for the publisher here, and it's published by Herbal Research Publications. Go to Amazon. It's got a Library of Congress number. Amazon will have it. And you'll have the information soon. And we're going to go to Chris in Santa Cruz. Hello, Chris, and welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning, Dr. Dawn.
Good morning.
I just heard you say that you prefer the generic drugs, and I have an apparent misconception around those, and I just wonder if maybe you can clear that up. I thought, or I understood it, that generic drugs are often kind of reverse engineered and by external companies that they, like, say, find aspirin on the market and they want to make their own. So they go and they break it down, and in doing that, may find the actual ingredients that go into making aspirin, let's say. But it's a process of how those ingredients are put together and how, you know, what the recipe is and putting them all together is where I understood it, that the generics are often not as good or not the same as the original medication. So is that bad information, I guess?
Yeah, it's mostly incorrect. Let me start with the process of generics, okay? When you get a drug to market, the chemical formula is public knowledge, okay? It's not an industrial secret like the formula for Dr. Weil's fabulous youth-retaining skin cream or something like that. They have to disclose publicly exactly the... In fact, the chemical structure is published, and exactly what it is known. So the law protects the inventor by giving them a period, generally 17 years, although there's tricks you can play to stretch that out. And they have 17 years to make their money back, essentially, by having sole control over the substance. But unlike copyright, which is renewable indefinitely, after 17 years, the substance becomes part of the general pharmacopoeia. Hundreds of years ago in Europe, back in the time of the medieval guilds, there would be medical breakthroughs that would be retained within a small family, and this was felt to be extremely unethical in medicine, and so with the and in pharmacology as well. So the idea being that when you discover something that's good for humanity, eventually you got to give it up and let anybody have the ability to make it. You can't just hold on to that patent forever. So the patent expires automatically, and when it does, other companies have that are generic companies. Bayer, B-A-R-R, being one of the more one of the bigger generic manufacturers, takes a look at it. They look at the process. How hard is it to make? They look at the market. Is there a large enough market to be worth making this stuff? And they'll generally choose fewer formulations. So they might make pills instead of capsules, and they might only have maybe 3 different milligrams available or something like that. And then they are then they can manufacture it, and they have to send their product to the FDA to be tested to make sure that it's within 5% up or down of the content on the label. So you get a little, if you've got, it says 30 milligrams and yours have 32 milligrams, you get a pass. Well, I guess 31.5 milligrams to be accurate. So you can shift a little bit. You can be a little bit off. That doesn't generally matter as long as it's consistent from batch to batch. Where you run into problems is, let's suppose that you have a 30 milligram pill. One manufacturer is making one that's 32 milligrams. It's still a pass. One's making one that's 28 milligrams. It's still a pass. But they're getting... But the difference between 28 and 32 when you switch from one generic to another could be a problem, because that's almost 5 milligrams difference.
Yeah.
So if you're, one of the bits of advice I have for generic users is you need to know the generic manufacturer, and you need, and it depends on the drug, but things like birth control pills, I think it's particularly critical, because a 5% shift in hormone content can make a difference in whether your birth control works or not. And obviously that has some adverse consequences if it doesn't work.
Yeah.
So it's not just that your blood pressure goes up 5 points for a week. It's, you know, a much bigger deal. So certain, in those situations, I definitely warn people. Things like thyroid hormone have been difficult to get right in terms of generics, and that kind of tends to paint the entire generic industry as a problem because of, you know, one drug, and that's just technical. It's hard to get a consistent bioavailable dose that gets absorbed in the appropriate amount, and it varies from compound to compound. And so most doctors know the generics that are problematic and the ones that aren't, and I'm always thrilled. Now, the one good thing about Medicare Part D, and I have very little good to say about Medicare Part D, but what it's done in my practice is my Medicare patients who have, let's say, a $200 or a $300 a month bill for their drugs, come in with their list and they say, what can I switch to generic so I don't go over $2,400 for the year and have to start paying for this stuff?
Is that the new legislation you're referring to?
Right. You get up to like $2,400 for your year, and then they don't pay for anything for $1,500, and then it kicks in and pays for everything. So there's like this real incentive to keep below that threshold. And people are saying, okay, what compromises can I make here that are going to keep me below that threshold? And it's easy. You come in, you ask for, you know, what can I make a generic switch to? And usually there's one or two I can switch on most people who are on six drugs. But when I try to suggest to them that we switch them to the generic, they're like, well, why should I? I'm happy with this drug, and it's not costing me. I'm not getting any savings from switching to generic, so I have no motivation to do so. And plus, there's this kind of, like, generic is like, do you remember the days when they made that generic food back in the 70s where you get the white label with a blue stripe on it and it just said dog food?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It was kind of weird. It was sort of...
Yeah, beans.
Yeah, exactly. It didn't go over well with the consumer because it felt like it was a step down.
And maybe that's part of the different performance factors on some of these. We come in, I mean, the power of the brain is so big in terms of our healing that... I wonder if certainly for me, I actually sort of felt that, I think it was a pain medication or something I had taken, that I thought that because I had the generic one that it was performing differently. And I wonder if it was just my head that was, you know, creating the different performance.
Well, it's possible. And, you know, difficult to do a double-blind placebo control study on yourself. So,
yeah.
But mostly what I'm treating are things where there's a measurable endpoint, like blood pressure, like cholesterol. So, you know, you can't...
Hard information, yeah.
It's much harder for me to buy into placebo effect on cholesterol levels.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like I'm measuring it. If it's placebo effect, I don't care as long as I'm getting what I want. And, you know, ditto for blood pressure. So if I gave them a sugar pill and their blood pressure dropped and was in the normal range, I totally would not care as long as the sugar pill continued to work.
Yeah.
In fact, I'd be happier because there's less side effects from the sugar pill.
Yeah,
you see what I'm saying?
Well, very informative. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And go to your doctor with your drug list and maybe save yourself some money.
Very good.
Okay.
Thanks
a lot. Bye-bye. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, and this is Ask Dr. Dawn. We're going to go now to Judith in Bonnie Doone. Hello, Judith, and welcome to the program.
Yes. I have a question that really troubles me about Fosamax. On NPR last week, I heard a horrible story about how 500 men take, or people taking Fosamax, have lost their jawbones to bone decay.
Oh, wait a minute. How Fosamax causing bone decay in the jawbone?
In the jawbone, and I wondered if you had heard that, and if you would follow up on it.
Where did you hear it?
On NPR.
Well, that's a credible source.
Yeah, I guess it is.
Okay, so let me, I have not heard that.
It
didn't catch any major headlines. My clipping service certainly didn't find it. So that's a good sign.
Uh-huh.
And I really don't know the answer to that. That's pretty strange.
Well, perhaps you could find out. I dropped it like a hot potato. I've been taking it since very early, since when it was one a day. And now I'm really troubled that I have the possibility of my jawbone falling out or whatever.
Yes, well, I would find that troubling too. But I actually don't get too worried yet. I have a feeling that this may be one study and with pretty dramatic results. But let me look into it, and I'll try to find that and come back next week.
I would appreciate
with some additional
that.
With some additional information, because that is pretty
horrifying.
Well, it's the sort of thing that gets into your head and just won't leave, isn't it? And then you start to take the pill and go, "Oh my God, am I poisoning myself?" Now, do you already have osteoporosis? Or are you preventing osteoporosis?
I'm sort of premature. I don't remember what that phrase was.
Osteopenia.
That's it.
Okay, so you're taking like one pill once a week.
Yes.
Okay. Now, how long have you been on it?
I don't really remember, but I do remember when I started, it was one a day.
At least 2 years?
Oh, many.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, let me tell you a secret.
Uh-huh.
You could stop your Fosamax and wait for a year and then resume it, and you would have no ill effects.
That was also mentioned as part of this.
So I think for your own peace of mind, just give yourself a drug break, because theoretically, if you don't have osteoporosis and you've been on the drug for years, then what will happen is very, very, very slowly the bone loss will resume over 6 to 12 months, and it'll resume at whatever its previous rate was. So you can stall. It's okay to stall until more information comes out, and I'm sure that'll reduce your stress level quite a bit just to have done that. So I think all drugs that are taken for prevention of a disease need to have a very high standard in terms of not causing any damage or disease themselves. Mm-hmm. If you have a disease and you're taking a drug to treat the disease, then you can weigh the side effects against the benefit of the drug and feel comfortable taking a risk. But if you don't even have the disease yet and you're taking a drug to prevent it, that needs to have a very, very low standard of damage. I mean, a low, low frequency of damage and risk. So let me look into it. You're a regular listener, I presume?
I am.
Okay, so I'll try to get back with it next week, if not the week after that.
Great, thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye. Bye-bye. So let's go now. We have just, I think, a little bit of time, but we'll go to Samantha. Hello, Samantha?
Yes, hi, Dr. Dunn.
Hi.
I wanted you to repeat your premise of how our studies and assumptions because of averages toss out the important information. It was so succinct, and I've got a pretty good handle on it, but not the...
Well, let me first, I'll give it a shot, but let me say that succinct is not my is not my forte.
Actually.
Also, it is on the show, and the show will be posted. If you are not a subscriber, I urge you to go to the website, Ask Dr. Dawn, and follow the pointers so that you can go to npr.org. Subscribe to the podcast, because then you'll have a copy of the actual succinct version. I'll try to restate it, and we'll take it from there. The premise here that is the flawed premise of medicine is that you can average out the differences between people and learn something useful. The idea that you can have a random sample of the population and that the way that random sample behaves will extrapolate, will be generalizable to any individual in the population. And because of the way we do our statistics, if something has a lot of variation in it, you need a big change in order to call something statistically significant. But now in the light of what we know about different enzyme patterns in people, anything that has a big variation, that probably means that there are multiple enzyme variants that are extremely important, and at least when we're talking about drug research or drug effects. So when we average out those differences, we're missing the point. We need to be identifying the subgroups. The premise needs to be, what are the important subgroups for this drug or for this treatment? And let's test the putative treatment within each of these subgroups and not average the responses among them, because we lose information, and in fact we obscure probably the most important information because it gets lost in the noise. And so we need to tune in on these subgroups as step one and then do the double-blind placebo-controlled study within the subgroup in order to really know, does an herb work? I think that's where a lot of the herb variation comes from, actually. You know, where you get one study that says black cohosh is great for menopause, and then you get another study that says nothing works for menopause. And meanwhile, I've got patients telling me, oh yeah, black cohosh rocks, or and also other patients saying, didn't do a thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, what if we change our model that there are different enzyme subgroups, and what I want is a test to tell me which person's going to respond to black cohosh. And
concentrate on the differences rather than throw them out.
Exactly. We've been doing medicine for the average.
Costly.
And our drug dosing, 70 kilogram males, that's what we calculate the drug dose for. I don't think I know a 70 kilogram male. We do medicine for the average, and nobody has ever seen this mythical average person with everything all blended together. We're not these smooth average balls. We're these spiky little star-shaped things with all kinds of variations. And we can't just grind off the edges and expect it to be meaningful. And that's been the metaphor for what we've been doing.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
I'm an avid listener. Uh-huh. I love your show.
Thank you very, very much. Well, it's been a wonderful show, and I hope that you've enjoyed it as much as I have. This is Dr. Dawn Motika saying so long and stay healthy.